So for our last main talk, it's my honor to introduce to you Father Bill Byrne. Father Bill Byrne is a native of Northern Virginia, originally, correct? And he is a graduate of the College of the Holy Cross, a church in the Jesuit tradition. And after graduating and working for a bit, he eventually entered seminary for the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., and was sent to the North American College. He was ordained a priest in 1994, correct? Okay. And among his various assignments in the Archdiocese, he had a rather long period at the University of Maryland as the Catholic chaplain there, which was a rather successful period there. With a number of priestly and other vocations, religious vocations that came out of that time, but a very vibrant campus ministry at that time, after which he was assigned to become the pastor at St. Peter's on Capitol Hill in Washington. And during that pastorship, he was also named secretary to Cardinal Wuerl for pastoral ministry and social concerns. So he had two day jobs, as it were. And then rather recently, he's been made the pastor of Our Lady of Mercy in Potomac, Maryland, where he's still the pastor there. I had the great pleasure of serving as a student brother as a deacon with Father Byrne at St. Peter's for 2 years, and then actually a third year as a young priest to give his vicar a day off every once in a while. And just on a personal note, just to say, when I was thinking about this conference, and particularly a talk about how preaching in the pulpit and liturgical preaching relates to the entirety of a priest's life, and particularly the life of evangelizing within the context of a parish and a diocese, Father Byrne was the first name that really came. Because he was one of the great examples to me of someone whose life as a priest exudes from every aspect of his life, whether he's walking his dog or cooking a wonderful meal for us in the rectory. It was always about preaching the gospel and living priestly life. And so I'm sure some of that will come across to us today in his talk. So without further ado, I want to present to you Father Bill Byrne.
Thank you, Father Austin. So the point of this talk is about preaching, sort of pastoral ministry in the context of preaching beyond the pulpit. And there's a famous admonition that we all hear: when you become a pastor, don't change anything for a year. And it's some things you're going to have to change beforehand, but the origin, I think, of this has to do not just with caution, but that the people need to trust you before they'll follow you. And so I'm a firm believer that trust is the key to effective pastoral ministry. And so this talk will begin with trust and end with trust. You see, you usually have to do one big funeral. The kid that's killed in the car crash, or the daily communicant, usher, sacristan, father of seven in the parish. You have to sort of put a stake in the ground in people's hearts before they'll really begin to walk with you. It takes some time. It's one of the frustrations, I think, when you hit the ground newly ordained and people are talking about your predecessor. And you come into a parish and the first thing that they do is the big funeral comes, and the last pastor comes to do the funeral. Because it takes a while for people to know you, and therefore to love you and be able to follow you and to hear what you have to say. But word does get out. When you think about the preaching and I think it's useful to go back to the classic rhetoric, that there are three elements of classic rhetorical oration: ethos, logos, pathos. Ethos, our ability to relate to people. Logos, the message that we're giving. Pathos, the call to action. And what I want to talk today is about ethos. You see, the ethos of Shakespeare, when we say we few, we happy few, we band of brothers, is trying to engage people. Most of the time we have this feeling like, oh, it's got to end up being a joke or a clever story. But I'd say it has to go much deeper than that, because it's not just the intro to your homily. It's really the appeal to your own character. And we hear this all the time, like Sarah Palin, I'm a hockey mom, saying I'm related to you. Joe Biden, oh, I'm just a guy from Scranton who's now Vice President of the United States. This, I get you, I relate to you. Just listen to the rhetoric constantly on the news each night. Is this appeal to character? But from a parish priest, you see, it has to be much, much deeper. Joseph Pieper, whom I'm a big fan of, the great theologian and philosopher, in his book, Faith, Hope, and Charity, talks about, in faith, two elements that help people believe something that they can't see, but they hear you saying. And that's whether or not it rings true to the heart, the message, as in the gospel. We don't need to worry about whether or not the words of eternal life are going to ring true in people's hearts. The other element is whether or not there is credibility of the speaker, whether or not hearing the talk, hearing the words coming from somebody that's inherently believable. And so how you present yourself in the pulpit, how you present yourself just around the campus of the parish, in the school, out greeting kids. You see, so much of this all happens at pick up and drop off in front of our school. This element of standing on the sidelines of a high school game or going to the play where people see you and they suddenly realize that you care. You see, this is one of the key elements I'd like to suggest of being a person that the people can relate to. And there are lots of elements. There are different people who have different liturgical styles that might clash within a parish, but need not. That a young priest who does things in a way that the more senior priest does that's different, as long as it's done by a person that is authentically caring about the gospel and authentically relating to the people, suddenly that stuff doesn't really matter. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to present to you perhaps a reading or of the story of the lost son that might give us some insight just as to how to build the ethos so that when we get up and give the logos with the capital L, people are able to hear it because they're able to recognize the word through the voice. That classic line that Pope Benedict brought up in his Jesus of Nazareth and echoing Augustine saying that the word is spoken, but it's the voice that projects it. The voice goes away, but the word stays in the heart. But in order for people to hear that, the ethos must be there. So think of the story of the lost son. Son comes and says, Dad, I want what's belonging to me. I want my share of the inheritance. Basically, Dad, you're dead. Then the father actually gives it to him. The son goes off, hookers, booze, the whole nine yards, finds himself not able to eat the pigs, goes back while he's a long way off. Dad sees him, runs to him. The son makes his confession. The father restores his sonship. And suddenly we see the mercy of the Father. This was the theme of the year, the merciful like the Father. But I'd like to suggest that it's also pastoral like the Father, that we experience generosity, that we experience in him patience, but we also encounter a silence of the Father. Let me explain. So generous like the Father, give me your share of the inheritance. The Father does it. The father says, yeah, okay, here, I'm going to give this to you. It's really an astounding moment, I think, in the revelation of just who the father is. And as representatives of the father, we who are called father in the life of the faith community, I recommend that this is a model, that most of the people we are encountering are in a time of pre-conversion, a time of pre-confession, and that our generosity as they encounter us, before they've come to the realization of their sin, and even as they're ongoing committing the sins which pull them from the Father, you see, we have to create a context so that when they return, they can return. So the question is what kind of environments have we basically created for our lost sons and daughters? I would say to many, if not most, the church, the Holy Catholic Church, its brand is the Church of No. This is what we hear. We're called discriminatory now by an uncatechized culture. All we hear is no, 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 no. Can I? No, no, we don't do that. Sorry, canon law. So we have to figure out how to undo this. So often, people would call and say, well, I called Our Lady of Fluttering Angels, and the church secretary told me that I didn't live in the boundaries, and therefore, I couldn't get married there. And you're like, the church secretary told you, how many sacraments could this couple possibly name? Two? Maybe, certainly marriage, now that they're actually looking for a place to get married. But we're this generation, the children of cohabitors now. So we can't hold this against them. If anything, the fault is not theirs, but it lies in ourselves that they haven't heard this message. So all of a sudden we have unchurched millennials, knock, 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 can I get married? And often they hear no, the church of no. You see, generous like the Father means creating conditions for awakening their return. Like even if you, for whatever reason, can't do the wedding there, facilitating the place. Now I know, you see, I know that when you do, and dealing with, for example, the culture of these marriages and weddings, it's become this distorted, monstrous, horrible thing, which was once a beautiful sacrament. And all the stuff on TV of getting, how do I buy the dress, and how do I, you know, what are all these crazy wedding shows, they seem to have waned a bit, but these reality TV shows, I think, come from a culture that knows inherently that something's there, but it's gotten completely lost and nobody told them how to find it. And so since they're already cohabitating, since they're also already basically in common law marriages, the wedding has got to feel like something, and they don't know how to make it feel like something. That used to be called the honeymoon, where you'd say, wow, marriage is fabulous. But it's not there anymore. And so you have to put stuff and fill bags with almonds and fill all these types of things to make the wedding actually feel real. And so it is that in the wedding world we encounter so much that is so hard for us to engage and to love. I remember one couple I had, and the bride was really horrible. And I've done probably upward of 400 weddings. You're at a university for 8 years, you're on a Capitol Hill for another 8 years, where the average age in the parish is about 26. You do a lot of weddings, two a weekend. Each one of these people are souls that have got to be saved. And they came and knocked on our door and basically said, save me. They didn't know they were saying that. But they said, I need a sacrament, and I don't really even understand why this is important to me, but it is. And I believe at their core of their being, they understand their soul. And so that's part of the attitude that we need to have. If we're going to be generous like the Fathers, you just can't say, okay, great, PNI, you know, are you going to accept children lovingly from God? Can you have babies and sex? Can you do all these questions? Do you have any children from other relations? Sign this, go take this class, and call me a couple weeks before the wedding. I think what we have to do is recognize that we're called to do all the hours of the marriage prep. Sure, we send them out to marriage couples and things like that. But when else are they going to meet with the priest? And the fact is that we all have full inboxes. And we all are trying to put roofs on our schools. We're all trying to get stuff done. But when is there a chance that we can go and grab them? To be generous like the Father, I think, also means that the wedding homily has to make a difference. You can't be like, wedding, blah, 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 Joni and Jim, blah, blah, blah. one of the things that I developed in my process, and I'm not saying this with hubris, I'm saying it honestly, it's rare that I do a wedding where somebody doesn't come up to me and say, that was the best wedding I've ever been to. And here's why. Because I had so many weddings and I wanted to make them personal, I developed a little system. I took a basic questionnaire, and the first question is like, why are you doing this? What do you know about God? What do you know about the other person? What do you know about this and about marriage? And the second question is, tell me your three favorite stories, but write them out and make sure that I can use these for the homily, because you'd be shocked at what people write. I had one guy, and he's like, I said, use this for the homily. He's like, my favorite memory was holding you in bed in Honolulu. I was like, this is like soft porn, and I'm having to read this. Forget it. I just was shocked. Most people have some sense, but it shows the erosion, you know, the discontinuity that people now are experiencing. But then, so then this third element, the third question is what... When did you know that this was the person you were going to spend the rest of your life with? What was the tipping point? So amidst all of that stuff, it usually takes about two or three pages, I sit down with the couple when I'm picking the readings, and I just highlight. I read it to them and ask questions. I do a highlighter, and on the back of the one page, I just write the main point. Because you can apply, you know, whether they get a flat tire on the way to the family vacation down in the Outer Banks, or whether it is the proposal story where he went to all this trouble, you can basically apply any one of those to the theology of a marriage. It's pretty easy. But the one thing that you're sitting to in front of is a whole church filled with the unchurched. An entire church. When are you going to have an opportunity besides a funeral and a wedding to have a whole church filled with people that don't go to church, that have the idea of the church of no, that have no understanding of the sacredness of marriage? And you get to talk to them. And the one common element, how do you apply to the ethos to a group of people that don't know you at all, is because it's evident you care about the couple. And what's the one thing that they're there for? They care about the couple. So it's like such a win. It's like such a tee up for creating a personal experience by just telling the story that they've told you. And all you have to do is look at it, because you've already written the point out when you did the last meeting 7 minutes before the wedding, and be like, oh, this is my story. It's just such a key up. So, generous like the Father, giving them the time, giving them the space, and giving them a decent homily. But it also means showing up at lots of stuff, being willing to be there so that people know. I have, some people find this surprising, but on my voice message machine, I say, this is Father Bill Byrne, I'm not in right now. You can call the vicar, or my cell phone is 301-943-6681. And I've only had one person who's like a vestment salesman who called me. And I was like, I wouldn't buy vestments from you ever, because you abused my phone trust. Goodbye. And but people that call really call. And the people that don't really have something leave a message. And I just find even just the symbolism of it is enough to people know, he's there in case I need it. So, patient like the Father. While I was still a long way off, he caught sight of the Father. And why did he catch sight? The Father caught sight of his Son. Why is he catching sight of his Son? Because he's waiting. He's standing there staring at the horizon, waiting for conversion and being willing to do that. And I think one of these things has to do is to preach confession, but then create an opportunity for people to go to confession. And a key, I think, to any pastoral success is having some form of adoration in your parish. I don't know how, when I got to many of the parishes, there was not even a credible understanding of the real presence. So you can't stand up and say, we're going to do 24-hour adoration, and people are like, adoration of what? And so it's one of those things where you eventually cook the frog, and you preach about it, and you create confessions. You know, I was blessed enough to be named to be one of the missionaries of mercy. And so we went over to Rome. It was clearly sort of planned by Vatican bureaucrats, because they had the actual investiture, or whatever it is, the commissioning, was done on Ash Wednesday, like the busiest day, busier than Christmas and Easter, is the day that people want to come and get dirt smeared on them. And they pulled us away, but that's okay, because I got to go to Rome. Hey, I'm not complaining. And so you go there, and in the Missionary of Mercy, in the big mass on Ash Wednesday with Pope Francis and St. Peter's, they had the remains of Padre Pio and Leopoldo Malchik, two Capuchins. I think they're Capuchins or whatever. Two Capuchins. I knew they were Franciscans, but they all kind of like fit in the same category for me. So, and they are incorrupt. And they wheeled them around, all around in these glass caskets. And it's pretty daggone amazing. They look fabulous. And I think that Padre Pio looks better now than he actually did then. But as they wheeled him around, the fact is that these guys would spend 12 to 16 hours in confessional every day. So often our window of time for confession, and so John Vianney, whom we just celebrated, that the amount of time and so often the windows that we create for confessional experience for people to come home for free to preach about, it's like, well, with that window on Saturday afternoon, like, nobody's available at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. That's like the worst possible time. We might as well do it, say, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. It's not gonna happen. So I think creating this place where people can find us waiting, where they know, where it's almost like open office hours, and they know they can come and meet us. You know, the people that we serve wait all the time. They wait 9 months for their baby to be born. They wait for them to come running out of school. They wait for them to come home from college. They wait for them at 12 at night when they're late for their curfew. They wait. And I think that embracing that waiting of the Father as pastors of souls is something that's pretty good for us to do, because it gives us an opportunity to experience what they are, but it also gives us an opportunity when they don't show up to get our rosary done and to work on our homily for the next Sunday and to do all these things, to sit in adoration. So the last thing that I want to talk about is this. He's silent like the Father. You know, when he says, Father, I've sinned against God and against you, I no longer deserve to be called your son. Treat me as you would your hired hands. And it runs so contradictory to our desire to help people be accountable. One of the things that I just said this year, and my principal wholly agreed, is like, no more dropping stuff off. If your kid doesn't have their lunch, they're not going to starve to death. We've got hot lunch in the school. If they didn't get their homework done, sorry. No parading through the school with a McDonald's bag or anything like that. It's done. Your kid will succeed in life more if you don't bring them. And it also adds a favor, like all the working moms are like, well, I can't do that. So we just put a no to it. But it's part of like this sense of accountability that we want to hold, and that's a good thing. And so in a certain sense, you want the Father to say to the Son, you're right. You're going to be treated like a hired hand. We're going to set up a payment schedule. We're going to work this all out. You are going to sleep in the barn. You're going to earn your trust back. Except he doesn't do that. He's silent to the confession, and he says, get a ring on his finger, get a cloak, kill the calf, sandals. My son is back. Like, what he does in that moment is restore his sonship. And he remains silent to the sin in us, but restores the dignity. And I think as pastors, there's a very important lesson to be learned in this. I think about 75 to 80% of being a good pastor is listening to your people and creating places where you can actually hear what they have to say, whether it be about their input on the homilies, if you're that kind of a person who likes to have a Bible study on the thing, but more important, like on what's needed in the vision of the parish. And that silence, because I believe that what we're talking about is restoring the son and daughtership of our parishioners so that they can take their rightful place in the body of Christ and be empowered to be hands and arms to your head, to be shoulders that hold the head up, to be people that actually get stuff done. But I don't have any crystal ball, and in terms of my prophetic vision of what the parish should be, I have some good ideas, I think, but I don't have all the answers. And I'm a firm believer that parish pastoral planning is an important part of building trust within the parish so that when you preach, they know that you are their leader, but they also know that you share their vision, that the Holy Spirit doesn't just talk to me. So when I arrived at St. Peter's on Capitol Hill, there had been a pastor there forever and ever and ever. He retired, but unfortunately was not required to move out of the rectory. They brought in another guy who was sort of a peer of his, a little bit younger, both from Ireland. And the old guy never moved out of the pastor's suite, sat at the head of the table, basically never stopped being pastor. And so it blew up about a year later. So I said I got word I was going to go there to help calm things down. And I Googled and it's like, what's that word for when people take over the ship? Mutiny on Capitol Hill. I was like, I thought I was going to this big plum, and instead it's a battleground. But what I did was, and I learned this lesson right away. I just called everyone together, and I said, here's different areas of our life of our parish that's dream. Like, I knew I could do nothing about the past, but I could get people focused forward, and then we'd move. So we set some basic goals. Like, we want intergenerational events. Very complicated thing. It's called a picnic. A picnic, and you just go get the young adults to pick up old people at their house. Ta-da! Like, it wasn't rocket scientist. It wasn't like, I didn't take out my quill pen and say things in Latin and things like that. But in the process of creating goals and reaching out to the same people, all the people in the parish, I immediately established myself as pastor. It wasn't the other way around. I didn't lose authority in the parish. I automatically gained authority because we had a common vision and people were part of that common vision. You have to know how to shut down ideas that you don't like. We all need to hold hands at the Our Father. No. I'm going to give you a quick little theology on that. We're going vertical, not horizontal. You have to be able to do that. So if you're not good at saying no, call me up, I'll come to your parish, or get the neighboring guy to do it. But my point is this. You listen in confession. Like, I really think when I go over and I teach homiletics at the NAC each year, so some very familiar faces here, and when I go over there, I tell them, I said, it's really hard to start preaching until you're ordained a priest, because you don't really hear confessions until you're ordained. So you don't really get to see where the open wounds are. Not that you get up and say, blah, 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 but you at least know where the woundedness and experience it for the first time in your life. And I believe again, so we have to listen like the Father. And immediately, as soon as we start listening to people, we start hearing some good ideas. We hear some bad ideas, but we hear some good ideas. But once people feel heard, they'll follow, especially if you can help them articulate it into a vision and a plan. And then you get them to do all the work because they're all part and enthusiastic of this. So the same old just doesn't work. And evangelization requires vision Vision requires strategy. Strategy requires buy-in and help. Buy-in requires engagement. And engagement requires people helping you and people telling you what they need. So I was kind of thinking about this today. There was something the other week of one of my parishioners was joking of the admonition to be to smell like your parishioner, the sheep, to smell like the sheep, Pope Francis. And what I realized is that for me to smell like the sheep, I have to be generous, I have to be patient, and I have to listen. Why? Because as our holy patron John Marie Vianney says, you and I, brothers, are the love of the heart of Jesus. Thank you. Any thoughts, comments? Yes.
You mentioned the church filled with the unchurched for a wedding.
Yeah.
Tell me what you would do about maybe some kind of an announcement about receiving communion.
Oh, I do that at every funeral and every, I get up and say, well, everyone's invited to this wedding. We're so delighted that you're here. Only practicing and prepared Catholics should come up to present themselves for communion. So don't feel pressured to come up. Feel comfortable staying in your pew and praying in your own tradition a special prayer for the people. And so if it gives them permission to stay seated without being like, you are excluded. So once I say, you have a tradition and that's fine, this is our tradition, so stay seated.
I know you're not really talking about marriage things, but there's a large portion of your talk. So how do you balance the need to be welcoming, as you're talking about, with also some of the basic requirements that the church imposes on us, like, you know, freedom, like what happens if you have somebody who's clearly has no interest in the sacrament, they're coming because mom is like, hey, and they're making that clear to you.
Yeah, I mean, this is, so when I was at St. Peter's on Capitol Hill, we had this beautiful church, and it's an ideal church to get married in. Long aisle, it's white, 1889, terrazzo floors, white marble, high altar, beautiful. So people were like, it's like a Vegas destination, you know, there were people. So we did have to set some limits as to that. But if I got there and I realized that the couple was not at all interested in doing this, I would sit down and I didn't really have any canonical obligations, like they were from another place. I always required that they go meet with their pastor if they wanted to get married there and get permission to be married. So it wasn't like I'm just like Wild West, you know, show up and I'll, you know, I'm the preacher ready to marry you. But that first meeting would always be two meetings. So I would say, here's the deal. You're not going to church right now. And one of the parts is like, if you're going to come get married in a church, the implication or really the explicit intention is that you want to be Catholic. And Catholic means going to church at the bare minimum. And then I say to them, if you are willing to start engaging in this and you're thinking, you know, we want to raise our kids Catholic, we want to do this. I said, I will stand in my head in the corner on Union Station singing a song every day to help you do that. I'll get a sign and spin it around on the street corner. But if you're not, can you cut me loose? And we'll help find you a place that's more authentic, because you don't want to do anything inauthentic on your day. So I say, it's your decision, not mine. I want you to come back next week and I want you to have prayed about it. And I want you to think about it. And then I'd get the sheepish call every once in a while. I'd be like, oh, we've come up with another plan. But then a lot of times, so in my experience, Ed, how many did we have in RCIA? Probably we ran two RCIAs because we had so many people on Capitol Hill, and by the nature of the community, people were in flux because it's all politicians and we had to follow election schedules and that kind of stuff. So we probably brought in over 40 people a year in RCIA, all in their 20s, and most of them because they sat in the office and got engaged in the marriage process. So I put it on them. I'm not like, hey, this is what it really means. And one of the stories I always tell is when I meet with, no matter what, I meet with a couple, I say, imagine if I had a bunch of extra money and I gave you $168. Boom. Go out and have dinner on me. Save it for something fun. Go do whatever. And as I'm talking to you and I walk away and I say, can I have $1 back? Would you give it to me? And they're like, yeah, I'd give it to you. And I'm like, yeah, it's totally stingy not to. I said, God gives you 168 hours in a week. And he says, can I have one back? I said, the 168 hours are for you, it's God's gift to you. Your 1 hour is your gift back to God. So it's, if the homily's boring, it's even better. Because it's a harder gift to give. It's beautiful, it's a win-win, no matter what happens. So trying to like engage them in that way, because you can say what you need to say. You know, like for example, when I talk about cohabitation, I'm not one that makes them move out, because it's often that ship has so long sailed. And even the couples that don't live together, and we can have pastoral discussions about this, you know, there's a prudential judgment in it, but you don't need the same mailbox to sleep together. You know, like these people are all going on vacations. They're like, their stories that they write me are like, and that favorite time when we went to the Outer Banks and we went, and I'm like, I don't hear any stories of like cookouts with grandmom in this, you know? It's like they're having honeymoons all the time. So what I try to do is engage them into the actual romance of chastity. Because it is much more romantic to have a honeymoon that was after you've been chased. And I've had a lot of couples came back and said, we did that, and it was really made a huge difference. And social science proves this right. If you just Google cohabitation and marriage, you see all these things. A whole bunch of articles coming through in the Washington Post about men unaddicting themselves to pornography, which is also something you address in the marriage prep. Yeah, well, one of the things that I wouldn't confuse outgoing with a lack of theological clarity. And I think that one of the things, at least in my experience, is that millennials, they don't know what they're standing on. There's nothing solid. And so when you preach, you're standing on the top of Fort Knox. You're standing on top of the highest peak, Everest or whatever. That it is possible, you know, when we talk to these couples, to speak the truth in love. And so I think one of the things that it can't be, I don't think theological vagueness is at all, it's not like I want to skirt around the issue of whatever. It's like cohabitation, I lay it out there. You know, and one of the things I say to people is like, I look at the groom and I say, someday you're going to have a beautiful daughter, God willing. And that beautiful daughter is going to grow up into a beautiful young woman. And that beautiful young woman is going to come to you and say, Dad, you know that guy, that dirtball that I'm dating that you hate? We're moving in together. And you're going to say, over my dead body. And then you're going to say, oh, she's going to say, but you and Mom live together. And you're either going to say, no, we didn't live together. Or you're going to say, I have no moral credibility. And just in the process of helping people understand that, I mean, I'm laying it out on the truth, but I think it can be said in such a way that people can hear it. That it's actually, because what we're really talking about is like a yes and not a no. Like a yes to having a much higher success rate for staying married your whole life is to be chaste before your marriage. The studies show it. Exactly. Exactly. If people know that you love them, that's an enormous difference. You know, it's like if they know you love them, they can hear a lot more from you than you'd imagine. Well, I mean, I think what the thing is to say, well, if you've had a couple that started to engage, so the last thing I always do at the homily is to say, of a wedding, I say, I believe that God's invited every one of us here. And so just as we saw in, you know, Guinevere and Tommy there, these elements, or with the scripture, because what you're really doing is using that as sort of just an intro to get to the theology of marriage. You see in that an opportunity to say, God's speaking to every heart in this church. And the question is what is he saying to you about knowing him? You know, because usually the theology of marriage has something to do with being called by name and God planning you and these type of things. And every life is intended. And to say, what is God calling you to? And are you in relationship to him? And most baptisms in marriage, I usually say, if he's not, call me. And I will help you take the next step. And it's, especially at baptisms, I always make that invitation because we do a lot of our baptisms are private. Because the demographics, we don't have the call for, we have more funerals now in Mercy than I did it. And so we do a lot of them individually and it creates a much better opportunity. But funerals, you know, the basic funeral thing is sort of like, in my mind, what I normally fit it into is praising God for the gift of the life of the person to the extent that you can, and then calling them to prayer, and then calling them to action. And so that calling to action is basically, I mean, it's easier, I think, at a funeral than it is at any other time, because everyone's like, oh my gosh, I don't want to be like. No, I do it with both. I mean, I do it with both in the, because I think it has to be part of a discussion. Because often in the culture of this sort of tolerance, she's probably aware that he's looked at pornography and isn't sure like what it really means. And when it's basically the equivalent of like, he's saying, okay, honey, I'm going to go and look in the neighbor's window. She's showering now, you know, it's like, it definitely fits in the creepy category, you know, and not something if you're looking for your ideal husband. So I always do that so that there's a sense of accountability. And also she's heard the message that if all of a sudden she's, you know, checking the history on his search engine, and she sees, you know, Buxy LaRue or whatever, then it's part of a larger discussion. But I also invite people to come, you know, if they want to come, and so we can start deprogramming. Yeah.
Do you just bring it up just with everybody?
Oh, I bring it up with everybody. I mean, you hear confessions. It's like, yeah. It's epidemic. This is not, especially if you hear a lot of younger people's confessions, and then it's, and the studies show it's moving down to like 9-year-olds. And then I'm on our formation board for the reading the applications for our seminary, and it's like the kid who does not look at pornography is the kid who was like homeschooled in a cabin without electricity, you know, on the Isle of Man or something. It's like that's the kid who comes in like homemade jeans and stuff like that. And they just haven't seen it. And so, but anybody else, it's there. So that's why it's like, yeah, I know. This is exactly what keeps me awake at night. So I agree with you, because you try to create this environment and people are engaged and friendly and, hey, Father, how are you? Want to go do this or that? And yet they take their kid to Catholic Church and don't go. So this is what we're doing now. Sort of, it was something that the Lord, we're trying to go after these low-hanging fruit. Like, this is our first swipe at this. And we're doing a program called Not On My Watch. I basically made it up. Not On Our Watch means not on our watch. You can steal this. Not on our watch will we lose the faith in our families. So that if your kid, if you don't go to church, this is our messaging to you, but we're going to roll it out like incrementally with statistics and interesting things and talk about it. And one of the things that we say is, okay, so if you take your kid but don't go to church, you get him confirmed, whatever, your grandbabies are not going to be baptized. Certainly your great-grandkids are going to, the faith will die in your family, in your watch. And so so it's sort of a challenge to awaken them. But one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to make one of the fundamental issues is that, because I noticed this year, like how we deal with parents at sacramental the sacramental moments, First Communion and Confirmation, they all the parents come in, they're seated in the church, the DRE and myself stand at a podium like this, and it's like, womp, 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 womp. What does it feel like? School. What do most people hate? School, all right? It all seems like school. So barring from this this obituary I read about Gary Marshall, it's like they asked him, you know, your shows don't seem Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley. They said, your shows don't seem like they have much content. And he says, most of TV is school. I want my shows to be recess. But in a certain sense, what I want to do is how can we shift a mentality so that people feel like church is recess, but actually they're running around and getting good, healthy experiences, and that they're coming in from the storm and resting from the place. How do we create this sort of safe harbor experience for people and create community? Because most of what happens, the people do stuff because they know people that are there. So they come into a church, it seems gray, headed, it seems like there aren't people, but you know, you start to create successful experiences, Bible studies or whatever, and then people find community and suddenly it's much more interesting. And so as part of this sort of overall messaging, we're gonna try and create community and build from community and message through that so that it doesn't just seem like, so our first event for our confirmation and second grade parents is going to be a cocktail party. And we're going to have a cocktail party, and we're not going to just hand them the reams of paper that say, this is where you buy the veil, and this is where you do this, and you'll have to have your name by this and the confirmation sponsor. We're going to get them there, but we're going to start by trying to create community. I don't know if it's going to work. And maybe we'll just be out a bunch of booze, but I'll report back to you. But I'm hoping if we can think the paradigm differently, and I want to make sure that when I say I want it to be recess, I'm not taking the cross out of this. I'm not at all taking this. I need to find them where they are and begin to walk with them. And most of them think church is school, and we do a good job of enforcing that often. And so what I want to do is try and create an experience where it feels more like recess, but you're really being fed. Yeah, it's an interesting, in terms of, I think the key is building, you know, it's encounter, as they keep saying, but encounter with each other. I don't really have that's a tough challenge. The kid comes, because there's nothing more heartbreaking than going over to school confessions. We started an adoration in the middle of the day for old people and for the school kids so that they get exposure. Never seen it, never heard of it. And their parents have, and we're trying to encourage. It's right before pickup. And one class comes over every time for confessions. And this, I'm sure everyone would agree with me. I find one of the most heartbreaking confessions is like a third grader saying, I've missed Mass. And you're like, oh, you didn't miss Mass, you know? And it's like, nobody took you. And, but the messaging of like, you gotta bring your kids to Mass just doesn't work. You know, like the sort of create the come as you are. I don't know the demographic of your parish, but I find that amazing because people seem to come in like pajamas and, you know, they can go to St. Peter's on Capitol Hill. My folks, now I'm in a wealthy parish, they all comes in like vineyard vines and they're all like, all the boys have like pink shorts and stuff. It's like super preppy looking. So we don't have that worry really. But any other thoughts? Last guy. Yeah, I mean, it's cooking a frog. It's a long process. That's why I like the second one. I was like waiting, you know, to try and get them to the very next step, because the son first has to go get the money, go to hookers, boom, 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 then the pigs, and not able to eat the sock before he wakes up and it's like, this sucks. And he's like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to get out of here. And so I think that's the process, is like engage relationship. Another thing I also do is just, I'm not, you know, if you have a couple that are baptized, you baptize your thing, like this sort of reach out a month in, hey, how you doing kind of stuff can be very effective for when then they actually do realize that they want to take the next step or they find themselves. Sadly, most of it is crisis driven. So they kind of have to wait for their mom to get cancer or something before they will reach out. But that's a lot of times the way, it was the people that knew they were sick were the ones that reached out to Jesus, not the ones who thought they were great. So just what I'm saying is this, well, I had one of my first pastors was an old Irishman, and Monsignor McGrady, and he said, when I got there, so I was a year ordained or whatever, he said, every priest needs to plant a potato. Plant potatoes. And I was like, why is that? He said, because then at the end of the season, you'll actually get to see that you've done something. And he said, so much of parish priesthood, you don't necessarily, you hear the voice through the screen, and you never get to see the fruit of what might have happened. Or the couple that you, and so it's great. Occasionally people loop back and say, I know you don't remember me. I just got a note like this. I know you don't remember me, but this, this, and this happened, and it all happened because of this moment. And so those are golden. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the two things that I think are key to this is having a spiritual director and actually praying so that you can discern, like on a regular basis, because it is, like I'm putting a $250,000 roof on the school. And while I hate putting money into something where the building is going to look exactly the same as when I started out, there's something immensely satisfying about a roof. It's like, I did something. There's a new roof, and I signed the contract, and I vetted three different bids, and there's a sense of like these kind of easy win feelings or whatever. But I always find that God kind of prioritizes for me. And then if I go back and I am doing an examination of conscience and sort of prayerfully doing, I can sort of weed out. I can weed out where what I haven't been. But you know, I just always put like the past, you know, of course, sacramental and pastoral first. And so and that's also why I think that it's helpful for me to have the cell phone on my voicemail. Because if it's really important, then people will let me know. As opposed to saying, Father, can I call you? And you've got seven messages and you're like, okay, well, I got to do this. And then somebody shows up and you won't get to them till later. But if you know this is really important, then you can deal with it right away.
Thank you, Father Byrne. Just a few things to conclude here. The first thing is just on behalf of the Thomistic Institute, thank you for showing up. Having a priest conference without priests wouldn't be much fun. But thank you. But I think in these days, just as a sort of kind of concluding remark, I think what we've seen is that particularly the office of preaching, the work of preaching in priestly life, has a lot more to do with who and what we are than what we do. We didn't just give you kind of tips and a list of things. If you just do X, Y, and Z, you're going to be a lot better and more effective. It's actually much more difficult than that, and much more subtle than that. But it's nothing less than what we've been ordained to, and what we've been called to, and given. And that identity, I think we've seen a number of times through these different talks in very different ways, that this identity is what allows us to preach the truth, and not just ourselves, or not just a program, or not just a message. But we preach the truth, we preach the word, but it has to come out of an identity, otherwise it's not authentic. We've seen that in different categories, I think, through the time. And then I think in the end, we've also been able to see that the task of preaching in our day then is that we have to make, with this identity, we have to make these opportunities for the gospel to be heard, which is radically different than maybe even what we grew up with. And so that's the world we're in. And so we have to have this kind of generous heart, which has to do with who we are, but create the opportunities in which people can hear that word in a way that maybe we never heard it and didn't need to hear it that way. And so this is the task. And this is why the Fathers of the Church call preaching the pastoral ministry the art of arts. It's the hardest thing there is, because you know, it's not clay, it's not building something, it's people, and it's the spiritual life and it's souls that we deal with. And so there's no amount of tasks and kind of skill sets that's going to make us perfect at this, which is our great consolation and the great thing that kind of spurs us on, it seems to me.